Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 369, Sunday, June 21st, 2020.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey everybody, KMO here. It's 8:41 a.m. Sunday morning. And wow, this is not a friendly environment for podcasting. Even though I'm alone, it's already very stuffy. It's supposed to get up into the 90s today. In Vermont, come on, that's not fair. I'm sitting next to an open window, but I have to stop speaking every now and again because cars drive by and they're quite loud. I have a notebook open in front of me on the tall table that I use for podcasting, but there's a black cat parked on top of it, so I won't be consulting any of those notes. But I'm going to push on, and hopefully I can filter out most of the car noises without making my voice sound particularly weird. And let's talk about, well, everything that's going on right now. You know, if you've been with me for a long time, you probably heard my audiobook version of the Unabomber Manifesto, or Industrial Society and Its Future, by Freedom Club, otherwise known as Theodore Kaczynski. And in it, there is a passage that is quite famous. It goes on for two or three pages, and basically he talks about the dysfunction of the leftist as a psychological type, and he tells activists and, you know, would-be revolutionaries against technology not to associate with leftists. And, you know, he describes them as basically just being angry, resentful people who want to tear down anything that is, you know, that somebody with more ambition and more focus has built. I mean, I'm leaving out a lot there. I don't want to go and revisit the whole passage. It's a long one. You've heard it. You're surely familiar with it. You can find it on YouTube. Just type in Unabomber leftist psychological type. I'm sure you'll find it. And then after several pages of, you know, saying how awful the left is, he then dismisses the right in less than a paragraph. He basically says, you know, and as bad as the left is, the right are completely useless and hopeless because, you know, they embrace capitalism and technological change, the two things which disrupt established social patterns more dramatically than anything else. And I don't know that that's necessarily true. I mean, an actual plague, a plague that killed a lot of people. You know, if we had the Black Death going right now, or if Ebola ever took hold in the U.S. and started spreading like wildfire, I think that would change our social norms very, very quickly and more dramatically than, say, dating apps have. Dating apps? What? Later today, I'm going to record a conversation with somebody who comments on my YouTube videos as first, and he's been listening to the Sea Realm podcast, he says, since high school, and he's in his 30s now, which is a strange thing for me to think. But he has created a documentary. It's a 2-hour documentary. It's on YouTube, and it is about just how the deck is completely stacked against millennial men and younger in terms of getting dates, because dating apps are great for the top 20% of men who, you know, look absolutely fabulous and attract the attention of women using the dating apps. But for the rest of the men who are on those apps, the apps are not only useless to them, they will not only not put them in contact with women who might be interested in dating them, but the apps are deliberately designed to keep these men, you know, on the platform, engaged with the app, even though, one, the ratio of men to women, I mean, there's many, many men on these apps for every woman, just as in, you know, before the digital era, when people put out personal ads in newspapers, it was very lopsided there as well. Far more men advertising for women than women advertising for men. But beyond just the statistical improbability of a man who is not, you know, already doing quite well with the ladies getting a date with a dating app, the companies that make these apps understand that the apps don't work for the young men, But the young men do work, you know, they do supply revenue to the app makers. And the app makers have taken this into account and simply designed their apps to monetize and increase the desperation, frustration, and anger of the young men who are trying to meet women with dating apps and who are manifestly failing. So this evening, I am going to record an interview with the author of that documentary. And the normal pattern is that a conversation will start on the main CROM podcast and then it will continue here into the vault. Well, I'm going to start the coverage of this topic on the vault, and then the conversation that I'll set up in this episode will continue on the main CROM podcast. We're going to start with the toppling of statues. Actually, let's start with the what was CHAZ, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone in Seattle, and which has become the CHOP, or I don't know what the P in CHOP is. It's the Capitol Hill Occupied something. Precinct? No, it stands for Capitol Hill Occupied Protest. So, as far as I can tell, just, you know, surveying various sources online, there are very, very few informed and honest depictions of what's happening there. Now, I'm not there. I can't say, you know, what's happening there. But, of course, I've seen, oh, there was a segment that Tucker Carlson did where he was, you know, they just had a collage, a video collage of all the damaged, basically, you know, street people who have congregated here. And it's edited together to just make it look like it's absolute, you know, bacchanal, drug taking, people pissing and shitting in the street. You know, it just looks horrible. And those scenes, you know, that I've just described, I've seen them. Saw them in San Francisco. I've seen them in Seattle. And it had nothing to do with any protest. So the fact that such people are present at the, you know, in the protest zone doesn't really tell you a whole lot about the protest itself. So that was obviously, you know, a very dishonest, prejudiced depiction of what's going on there. And, you know, it's for the Fox News audience. What do you expect? But, you know, I've also seen depictions of it where it's depicted as just this heroic struggle against oppressive forces, which that's really a stretch. It's really a stretch. Also, I've heard people who, you know, have various agendas at work in reporting this describe the occupied zone as being in the middle of downtown Seattle. It's not. It is not in the middle of downtown Seattle. You know, Seattle, like any city, has got a variety of neighborhoods. Some of them are quite far from the others, you know, so downtown is pretty far from the University District. Capitol Hill is pretty far from Fremont. Capitol Hill is definitely not in downtown. They are different neighborhoods. It is a, you know, a breathtaking walk, like a 20-minute walk uphill from downtown to get to Capitol Hill, or at least to the neighborhood in Capitol Hill that is being occupied. So there's just, you know, ignorance that people reporting, they're looking to promote a worldview. And the fact that it's not in downtown Seattle is irrelevant to them. There's no reason for them to seek out any particular details. And the only people who really understand how utterly clueless, you know, how little information is being used as the basis for these narratives that are being spun, the only people who are going to know that are people who either live in Seattle or used to live in Seattle, or for whatever reason, go there often enough to know that Capitol Hill is not downtown. But as you probably know by now, the country has polarized into what I consider to be lunatic left and traditional right, which has always been pretty objectionable. You know, the culturally right-wing, anti-intellectual, semi-paranoid, you know, mentality has never been attractive to me. I came up considering myself to be more aligned with Democrats and, you know, people who were against racism and homophobia and things like that. But even in my youth, you know, I had that libertarian thing going, which most of my, you know, mainstream Democrat or left-leaning friends just found incomprehensible. But I am so much more on the outside looking in than I've ever been before, because to me, I mean, particularly on Twitter, and I am the first to say and acknowledge Twitter is not the world. Twitter is not the real world. Twitter is not representative of the opinions of people at large. But I've just seen so much cackling on Twitter about activists who got normal people fired from their jobs because they said something that wasn't quite right in terms of, you know, the political speech policing codes that are in effect in certain places. You know, and those places aren't necessarily physical, like university campuses or tech company HR departments, but, you know, they're also virtual spaces like Twitter. Twitter is weird in that it doesn't have that many users. Compared to Facebook, it is nothing. It is, you know, in terms of its reach, it might as well be LiveJournal. But there are a lot of mainstream journalists who are on Twitter. You know, there are the blue check marks on Twitter, which is to say public figures, and it's verified that this is this public figure's actual Twitter feed. Twitter is basically, it has become a means for people who don't really have the social prominence to release, you know, to put out a press release that is going to get picked up by major news outlets and commented on, but it allows everybody to put out a press release. But, you know, for people who just use it sort of as what it used to be called, a microblog, you know, and a blog is a web log or a journal, you know, people who are just using it to dash off quick thoughts about whatever is in the news right now, if anybody ever decides that they don't like you, that you're a problematic person and you need to lose your job, step one, go to the person's Twitter feed and comb through as many tweets as they have left up on the feed and find something, anything, that can be described as problematic or racist, and then bring this Twitter evidence to the attention of their employer and demand that the person in question be fired. Many businesses in places like New York, Seattle, Boston, San Francisco, they are so concerned about maintaining their, you know, their anti-racist credentials that they will fire anybody on very little evidence. So right now, with the riots, and there surely have been riots, with the protests, and there surely have been well-organized, well-meant, peaceful protests, some of which were perverted by, you know, agents provocateur, some of which turned violent organically, spontaneously. But the narrative on that side of the divide is that the protests and any resulting or accompanying unrest, looting, arson, assault, murder, all of which have happened, that these are all the results of systemic police violence directed disproportionately at black and brown people. As I understand it, that is absolutely contrary to the evidence. Now, statistics are slippery here because not all police departments record encounters with citizens in the same way. They don't always include a description of the race of the person who, you know, had been handled by the police. But the data, as I understand it, indicate that police officers are more likely to put their hands on black citizens that they are, you know, in contact with than they are white citizens. But they are more likely to kill white citizens. So more white people than black people are killed by police, but you would expect that because there are a lot more white people than there are black people in the United States. But even per capita, white people, and I'm sure you can picture them, poor, cognitively low-functioning, often drug-addicted street people, basically. You know, they might have a place to go, but they're at home on the street. They can certainly go and hang out with the homeless folks and feel quite, you know, quite at home. People in this subculture and this, you know, economic strata are more likely to be murdered by police if they are white than if they are black. So the idea that there is all of this crypto-racism, that people walk around 999 hours out of 1,000, mouthing the right words, you know, to pass as non-racist or secret racist, just waiting for the moment, you know, to strike a blow for racism. That's the narrative I see on Twitter. Here's a tweet from Alex, who has a blue hat next to his name on Twitter, which means he is a member of the Yang Gang. And he posted, "There are going to be two types of parents telling their stories about 2020 to their kids. One, I fought for changes in the police system to help end police brutality and the unjust killing of black people. Two, I fought for my right to not wear a mask in public." Well, you know, I haven't been in the streets to fight for either of those two things. Although I absolutely agree that policing as an institution in the United States, is so broken that arguably it does more harm than good at this point. But I also realize that, you know, if the police were to be abolished or severely curtailed by defunding, that the people who suffer the most are going to be the poorest people. They will be disproportionately black and brown. But many whites as well, poor whites, who sometimes need the assistance of the police, will be left high and dry, where upper middle class, professional managerial class, and, you know, above, will be just fine, because their neighborhoods will be guarded by professional private police forces. Now, I'm not as familiar with the right-wing narratives. I mean, I know, to some extent, that a lot of folks on the right wing, and not even the extreme right, you know, even center right, are pretty sure that maybe George Soros isn't the architect of all of this unrest, but he's certainly, you know, throwing a lot of money into fanning the flames. Now, maybe you recall an episode or two back, I was talking about videos I had seen online of pallets of bricks left in places where protests were scheduled, you know, when there was no construction around. Well, I looked into some debunkings of that claim, and I found several instances in which, you know, these pallets of bricks, which didn't seem to be in proximity of any construction in the video, were in fact there for the purposes of construction, and in some cases had been there in place since before George Floyd was murdered in Minneapolis. You know, the right-wing narrative is basically that George Soros bought huge pallets of bricks and paid people to deliver them to places where protests were going to take place so that the protests would turn violent. Or, you know, when the protests turned violent, people who wanted to throw bricks would have bricks at the ready. Well, as I say, I've looked at a couple different debunkings of this idea, and in many of the most iconic images of pallets of bricks, people who have looked into it have found photographic evidence and sometimes video evidence that those bricks had been there since before George Floyd was murdered, which is to say before all of this recent unrest. Because a few instances of this have been debunked, has the whole idea been debunked? I don't know, but in my mind, largely, yes. But I was talking to somebody who probably wouldn't want to be identified in this context, but who was telling me about information that, you know, he was privy to about how George Soros Open Society Foundations basically cultivate. They pay to support and train social activists, and the training that they get is suspicious. So just, you know, Googling around on that topic, I find an article in PolitiFact, and the headline is, "No, George Soros and his foundations do not pay people to protest." And this is in response to a public statement by Candace Owens, someone of whom I am no fan. But apparently, Candace Owens had tweeted out, "George Soros is funding the chaos in Minneapolis via his Open Society Foundations." And PolitiFact says, this is the, if your time is short, you know, the too long didn't read summary. Candace Owens first guessed and then continually claimed that George Soros and the foundations he funded had funded the chaos in Minneapolis. Soros and Open Society Foundations say they do not support violence. Open Society Foundations has not given grants to organizations to support violent protesting. So that is PolitiFact's verdict. And, you know, I've spoken to people and one person recently who claim to have seen evidence to the contrary. That George Soros not only funds protest leaders, but, you know, supports them long term and flies them around the world to get them training from a variety of nefarious sources. Now, anytime the name George Soros is invoked, my eyes roll back. And if I'm trying to be polite, then, you know, I suppress the urge to roll my eyes. But that's mostly because I've heard his name invoked by people spouting just what to me sounded like absolute batshit, insane conspiracy theory. But this first segment is getting a little out of hand. So let me just say, I have lived in Japan. I have talked extensively to people who have lived in China, Asian countries, you know, particularly East Asian countries, are so racially conscious. You know, somebody who hasn't been there and lived there for a time, just, you know, from the United States, it would be difficult for you to imagine just how race-conscious Japanese and Chinese societies are. And yet, The claim from the left here in the West is that the United States is a uniquely racist nation, that it is just built from the ground up to oppress people of color. Maybe you believe this. I don't believe this. It is not consistent with my lived experience. I have been elsewhere. I have seen how other countries do things. The United States does things, you know, particularly when it comes to ensuring the rights of its citizenry. Doesn't do it perfectly by any stretch, and it doesn't provide, you know, equality of outcome, not by any stretch, but it does a pretty good job compared to other places where I've lived. But this is what's key. The people who are protesting, you know, particularly the people in Minneapolis, who live in the place where George Floyd was murdered, these people are under a lot of pressure. You know, economic stress, which had been building for decades, and which was suddenly thrown into overdrive by the pandemic and the resulting lockdown. You know, these are people under stress. We're all under stress right now. But, you know, the poorer you are, the more precarious you are, the more dependent you are on your very next paycheck, you know, to sustain your way of life, the more pressure you're going to feel. People under pressure feel the stress of it. But that doesn't mean they understand what is happening to them. People under stress are thus susceptible to being manipulated by stories that exploit their desire to see themselves as uniquely justified and uniquely aggrieved. So, putting everything in racial terms, excluding class and denigrating and demonizing anybody who talks about class as a class essentialist and therefore a racist, brings together at least a couple different factions of people. One are people, you know, black people who I simply cannot blame them for thinking that police are racist because they don't see that the police treat poor white people just as harshly and viciously as they treat poor black people. So folks in that situation who have had a lifetime of very negative experiences with police officers, particularly when they were young men, the story that everything that is wrong with the United States comes down to racism, that meshes very well with their lived experience. But that same story appeals to professional middle-class people who intend to give away none of their share of the unequally distributed wealth and opportunity of this society. They don't plan to give one inch in terms of their share, their cut of the material wealth of the society. But if they can get on board and post to Twitter how much they hate racists and do everything they can to ferret out secret racists. And, you know, when their friends or their close associates, whom they understand are not racists, get accused of racism, well, they have to pile on as well or stay silent. And it's all in the service of directing attention and keeping attention directed resolutely away from issues of economic inequality. So you've got, you know, the people who have been the targets, the objects of mishandling, rough treatment by the police, not just once, you know, but time and again, living their lives as they do, the story that everything that is wrong with America is a result of racism brings together people whose, you know, class interests are very, very different. But this story appeals to both classes of people. One, because it paints them as, you know, being the most victimized people in the society, and thus the most aggrieved and the most deserving of, you know, the benefits of a redistribution. And the same narrative says to the people in the professional managerial class, hey, you're not a racist, right? Everything that's wrong with this country is a result of racism and those vile, awful, flyover state racists with their Hawaiian shirts and their machine guns. You don't have to worry about the distribution of wealth, income, or opportunity. That's not what's at issue here. What's at issue are those bad people in the red tribe. You know, John Michael Greer did a blog post about this a few years back now. And what I'm calling the professional managerial class, he called the salary class. But, you know, his position was that the salary class, not only do they make more money and have better benefits for the most part than people who earn wages, you know, who trade the hours, the individual hours of their life for a set dollar amount, but the salary class also gets the benefit of living in a third world country where there is lots of cheap, desperate labor ready to do whatever you need doing. You know, whether it's your nails, your hair, looking after your children, mowing your yard. basically the professional managerial class gets to live as if they were diplomats stationed in a foreign country that is poor. You know, whereas at home, they might live in a split-level ranch house with three bedrooms and, you know, no domestic help. Send them to live in a poor country, you know, on the government's dime, and suddenly they have a driver and a maid and a nanny and a groundskeeper and, you know, they have lots of cheap labor around to elevate the quality of their life. Well, you know, in the 2020s, that's life in the United States for the professional managerial class. Now, unfortunately, the folks who are opposed to what's going on, you know, to this race hustle, which has brought together, it hasn't aligned the material interests, but it's given motivation for professional managerial class people and, you know, poor people from the streets who are fed up to basically mouth the same slogans. And it has justified mob violence, which I can't stress this enough. If you are a participant to mob violence, not the object of it, not threatened by it, but, you know, you are part of the mob taking part in the violence, it is an unbelievable high. It is so thrilling. It is so much fun. And if you are doing it not because your team won and you're just so excited, but because, you know, you are a member of an aggrieved class and this is your moment to strike back against injustice, to mix righteous indignation with mob violence, oh my God, you can't beat that feeling. So, both here in the US and in Britain, the mobs have discovered that it's a lot of fun to tear down statues. And so they're coming down left and right. And, you know, for the most part, I'm not going to miss them. It bothers me that mob violence goes, you know, uncontrolled, but, you know, control of other people is not my fetish, so I'm not up in arms about it. But it is troubling. As you probably remember, I lived in Tennessee for a couple of years. I lived on the farm. And one of the things I did to make money while I was on the farm was drive to the airport in Nashville to pick up people who were coming in to visit the farm. And more specifically, to visit the Eco Village Training Center. So I drove, you know, it's 90 minutes each way. It's like a 4-hour commitment to, you know, drive from the farm to the airport, pick somebody up and bring them back to the farm. But I made that drive many, many times. And pretty much every time I made it, I passed a statue of Nathan Bedford Forrest. He was a Confederate general. He was also in the Ku Klux Klan. It is Nathan Bedford Forrest that Forrest Gump is named after. So there was this statue of Nathan Bedford Forrest that you could see as you drive by on I-65. Not only is it, you know, a controversial image, because here is a Confederate general and, you know, avowed defender of the race hierarchy on display, the statue is so poorly executed that it is just ridiculous. Forrest is on his horse. His horse is rearing up. He has in his right hand a saber which is raised above his head. In his left hand, he has a pistol which he has pointed back behind him, so he's not looking where he's pointing the pistol. The horse has no headgear. It has no bit. It has no reins. And, you know, he couldn't hold them. Even if the horse, you know, was appropriately attired to be ridden, he wouldn't be holding the reins because he's got weapons in each hand. The statue is roughly correct in its proportions, but the pose is so stiff and awkward and unrealistic. The facial expression is so unrealistic. It just doesn't even read as human. It's just weird. And then to top it off, the horse and rider are different colors. I mean, each is a solid color. It's not painted. It's a monochrome statue, but it's like it's made out of two different materials. And from the highway, it looked to me like it was made out of plastic. It looked like a little tiny plastic miniature, which had been scaled up, but, you know, hadn't been given the appropriate level of detail that you would do if you were scaling up something that was small. I mean, it was just poorly executed. It looked ridiculous. But it was on private land. It was a privately owned and commissioned piece of art, in air quotes, art. It was visible from an interstate highway, but it was on private land. So there was no way to remove it, you know, via any sort of above ground electoral or political process. Somebody just dumped pink paint all over the thing. And the owner of the statue says that he's not going to repair it. He's going to leave it as is to draw attention to the fact that the statue has been vandalized. The funny thing is, the statue looks less ridiculous now than it did before, because now it's all one color. It's pink. It looks less stupid now than it did before it was vandalized. But this statue is an exception. I mean, a lot of the statues that are coming down are expertly executed busts or, you know, full body statues of famous people. People who today are considered monsters by the left because they didn't hold, you know, the social values of people in the professional managerial class living in the 21st century. So I'm going to invoke John Michael Greer again, and in fact, a quote from his most recent blog post, which is about very esoteric topics. It is about spiritualism and, you know, occultism in the early U.S. But in getting into that topic early on in the piece, John Michael Greer writes, quote, "The current fad for simplistic denunciations of American historical figures can be seen, in fact, as blowback from the era of equally simplistic glorifications of those same historical figures. Both these simplifications have the same goal, which is keeping people from learning anything from history." Close quote. Well said. You know, when I grew up, mostly in the 1970s when I was in elementary school, for example, I didn't know who Nathan Bedford Forrest was. I don't think I knew who, any of the Confederate generals were. But I certainly knew who Christopher Columbus was. Christopher Columbus discovered America. And he did so by bravely sailing over to, you know, across the horizon at a time when everybody thought the Earth was flat. Well, you know, very few people actually thought the Earth was flat at that time. And, more importantly, when Christopher Columbus reached the Americas, he never set foot on the North American continent. You know, he basically found the Caribbean and Caribbean islands. He got there and he set up shop as a slave master. He basically enslaved the locals and put them to work in the service of the European crowns. And so today he is, you know, I can't say wholly undeservedly painted as a monster. And it's weird that, you know, in my lifetime, he has gone from somebody who has been uncritically glorified to somebody who is now very simplistically vilified. So now, as far as I can tell, the code of approved thought in universities these days basically has to denigrate and vilify everything about Western civilization, because the people who had been held up uncritically as important seminal figures in the foundation of our culture, because they didn't have the same set of values as people are supposed to have today, now they must be canceled. They must be expunged. You must... Basically, if any historical figure who said something that people in the past had to study and understand, if they held any views which were unpalatable by contemporary leftists, well, they have been canceled and you are no longer responsible for understanding what it was they had to say. They were bad people, and you are under no obligation to make any effort to understand what bad people tried to say. So Colin Wright, and I can't say I know a whole lot about Colin Wright, is quoting an article here on Twitter. The article is from Quillette. And he has drawn a quote from this article. The quote is, quote, "As I see it, these demands to decolonize the university seem tailored to ensure that students learned absolutely nothing in university except a bloated regard for their own internal realities. You know, I studied philosophy. I started studying philosophy in community college. And if you study philosophy, at least, you know, prior to the current moment, if you studied philosophy, you were going to encounter the words and ideas of Plato and Aristotle, both of whom lived in a society that practiced slavery and who didn't really seem to have anything to say against slavery. So these are now slave apologists. But when I was, you know, learning philosophy for the first time, I had to read the works of Plato and Aristotle. I then had to write about them to demonstrate my understanding of those works. Today, I don't know how they teach philosophy, because it doesn't take but 2 seconds to demonstrate that Plato and Aristotle didn't have the same social values of 21st century college students, which means, you know, they were bad people, they were problematic, they were racist. You don't have to extend any effort whatsoever to understand what a racist believes. So if you just memorize the main points of the social justice grievance agenda, you're off the hook for, you know, making any effort whatsoever to understand and demonstrate your understanding of something that you don't already know and agree with. Okay, I've taken a little too long to get to this, but the past few minutes have been my attempt to set up a longer quote from Mark. Mark C., who you have heard on this very podcast, he is one of the participants in the Sea Realm podcast discussion group on MeWe, and in response to the John Michael Greer quote, which I'll repeat now because it's been a few minutes since I originally put it on the table, quote, "The current fad for simplistic denunciations of American historical figures can be seen, in fact, as blowback from the era of equally simplistic glorifications of those same historical figures. Both these simplifications have the same goal, which is keeping people from learning anything from history," close quote. To which Mark writes, "Hard for me to take any umbrage at the toppling of Southern Civil War leaders. As a mea culpa, I'll have to admit that on a yearly business trip to an unnamed southern city, I did grievous bodily injury to a statue of Robert E. Lee, and the damage accumulated, apparently without repair, over a period of 5 years. That said, I always thought it might be better to just leave these odious statues standing, leave them with a message that reflects not a trendy historical narrative, but what I think, in good conscience, we can say about someone like Robert E. Lee. Here stands a man much hated and reviled by his own men, a man in favor of human torture and bondage, and a traitor to his nation. Something along these lines would suit me. Robert E. Lee is an easy target, though. Many historical figures are, to a reasonably and honest observer, multifaceted and nearly unknowable. Johnny Appleseed is a great example. Why add heroism or evil intent at this point? Ancient characters also come to mind, like Marcus Aurelius, philosopher king extraordinaire or poor administrator, enemy of Christ, misogynist, and pro-slavery dictator. At the risk of being tarred as an enemy of some sort, I will boldly agree with John Michael Greer here. The current metrics just don't apply to Marcus Aurelius, or Johnny Appleseed either. That doesn't require us to embrace slavery or sexual deviance, as these characters might have. It just requires us to be reasonably objective and withhold unnecessary moral judgments about the past. The slow dissecting of historical narratives and attempt to place the best ideas of ancient people meaningfully within a current context was a large part of what used to be called a liberal education. This was the idea behind the Great Books curriculum, now reviled on the left and right, a process of thought and dialogue that took place over 4 or more years. Good question, though. Quote, "And what happened the last time that was tried?" Close quote. No one right or left or center seems to care anymore. Not a great fan of John Michael Greer, but he is right that there is very little that is new, and so we might as well ponder how social movements and organizing tools were used in the past. To some degree, the left does this, but seems almost insanely unaware of it. Most left academic literature and critique is really a rehash, often worse, of ideas that have been around for 100 years or more, with occasional great, well, perhaps minor, fanfare. So, end block quote from Mark C. So, I think it is time to sum up. The United States and, as far as I can tell, the English-speaking world generally, with the exception possibly of New Zealand, is in a cultural uproar right now. The United States has been, you know, in economic decline for some time, but not for everybody. This is a headline from a very recent Forbes article. The headline is, "The net worth of America's 600-plus billionaires has increased by more than $400 billion during the pandemic." We live in an age of, you know, crisis capitalism, where every crisis is an excuse to give enormous amounts of money, unprecedented sums of money, to the wealthiest class in the United States. Can you see how it is in the billionaires' interests right now for that fact to be lost amidst all the turmoil around racist cops? Now, what I have just described over the course of the last, you know, better part of an hour is a story of me seeing patterns and, you know, levels of conflict and interest that most people don't see, that I am seeing through the illusions which have captured so many of my fellow Americans and led them to get off on denouncing people in the opposing cultural tribe. I don't see everything by any stretch. You know, I certainly don't understand all of the machinations, the financial machinations that take place in Washington, D.C. and New York City, much less London. I don't know all the workings of the deep state, you know, the national security state. I'm certainly not privy to the discussion, you know, behind closed doors in K Street lobbying firms, very few of which I understand are actually located on K Street in Washington, D.C. anymore. I just see that people have a lot of reasons to be upset. They are upset, but they have been suckered by narratives which flatter their self-image into misdirecting their anger and to demonizing anybody who suggests that there is a, you know, systemic, class-based economic inequality which is driving so much of the hardship that people are experiencing. And this can't be stated often enough. The police who rough up poor people, be they white, black, brown, or, you know, whatever other color you like to distinguish, they're not bad apples. They are not deviating from their training. They are doing what they are supposed to do, which is protect the wealthy from the rest of us. Right now, it is convenient for the wealthy to throw their police servants under the bus and call them racists. But they're certainly not going to give up their private security. So, pulling things out to a very general level, you know, bringing it in for a close, I want to quote Thomas Ligotti here. Thomas Ligotti, author of The Conspiracy Against the Human Race, A Contrivance of Horror, the person who, for the most part, introduced me to the concept of antinatalism, he tweeted the following. Thomas Ligotti writes, "The crisis of modern society is precisely that the youth no longer feel heroic in the plan for action that their culture has set up. They don't believe it is empirically true to the problems of their lives and times." A week ago, there was a Black Lives Matter march here in Bellows Falls, and I went to document it, and it was basically all the young people in town, plus, you know, the old hippies, some of whom are quite wealthy, marching around the town, you know, saying, "No justice, no peace, Black Lives Matter, say his name," all the slogans. As I stood there and photographed the line of people walking by, I noticed one person in line who could easily be worth more, you know, in terms of his personal wealth than everybody there under the age of 30, put together. It is definitely in that guy's interests, you know, both just coldly calculated financial interests and in terms of his, you know, his self-image, to associate himself with the fight against injustice. But this is a mostly white community, and it is very unequal in terms of material wealth and access to opportunity. The struggle for economic equality and equality of opportunity for people of all skin tones is complicated. It requires some understanding of economics, and it requires some understanding of economic history, which is a boring topic. The idea that you are fighting against a society in which most white people over the age of 30 really are Ku Klux Klan members who just don't put on the robes out of, you know, simple self-preservation. That is a very easy to understand narrative. And to fight against this culture of crypto racists, that's a heroic plan of action. It's based on a very distorted worldview, but it is heroic. To take action as a group, to stand up and scream with one voice, "Black Lives Matter, no justice, no peace." It feels heroic, it's empowering, it's exciting, and you get to feel morally superior to the sort of, you know, generalized society in which you exist. It's based, I won't say on a lie, although that's, you know, a very powerful thing to say, it's based on a lie. It's based on a false worldview. It's based on, you know, a worldview that rests on easily disprovable statements. But it's easy to understand. It allows them to participate in collective action, and it feels good. So while I will continue to do what I can to bring some nuance, you know, to bring some additional nuance into the stories that people navigate by, I can't blame, you know, an 18-year-old, a 20-year-old for being swept up in this narrative and for getting caught up and addicted to the wonderful feelings that it produces when they get on Twitter and they denounce racists. And the program for ferreting out a college professor's, perhaps, you know, misstatements, a drunken 3 a.m. tweet from 4 years ago, the system for finding their missteps via social media and presenting it to authorities to get them fired is an established pattern. You don't have to work it out. You don't have to figure out how to get it done. It's a, you know, it is a step-by-step turnkey process at this point. I would be surprised if AI and machine learning haven't been brought to bear to facilitate this process. If it hasn't yet, it certainly will be in the near future. So let me just end with a very specific, concrete, practical piece of advice to any of you out there who use Twitter and who have jobs that it would hurt you. It would diminish your standard of living and quality of life to get fired from this job in such a way that you wouldn't be eligible to get hired on in a similar capacity anywhere else. There are tools that you can use to delete all of your old tweets. I haven't done it in the last year, but it's on my to-do list. Once a year now, I delete all of my tweets that are more than a year old. I myself am never going to go back and review my tweets from 5 years ago. But if somebody thinks that they can, you know, take my head and mount it on their wall as a trophy by going and finding my past missteps on Twitter, and they don't have to be anything, you know, overt, they can be taken out of context, you know, they can be just merely suggestive when set up in the right way. I don't keep those old tweets around. They're of no use to me personally, but they are not for me so much a vulnerability, but for most people, people who have jobs from which they can be fired, your old tweets are a definite liability. You should delete them. There are tools that you can use. I haven't used this particular service. I just did a search, tools for deleting old tweets. There's a website called tweetdelete.net. Easily delete your old tweets. I suggest you do this. Honestly, have you ever gone back and reviewed your own tweets from years past? Probably not. But if you're really intent on preserving your creative output, if you consider your tweet history to be, you know, your novel in progress, your blog, your autobiography, you know, your memoir, then just scroll through your old tweets and do a screenshot. Get several at a time and keep the screenshots. I guarantee you, you'll never look at them. Although if you do go back and look at your old tweets, you're probably going to, one of two things will happen. You'll either get caught up in, you know, the emotions that led you to tweet things that made you vulnerable, or you'll look at something that you wrote 2, 3, 5 years ago in a moment of emotional peak, and you'll think, wow, I was really, really taken in by whatever worldview motivated this. I was really channeling something there, wasn't I? Delete them. They are a liability. They are a vulnerability. Even if you have no bad intent, if you are as woke as, you know, Sleeping Beauty is unwoke, those old tweets will be Exhibit A in your show trial. Delete them. And with that advice given, you know, the real secret to successful advice giving is to have no concern whatsoever whether or not one's advice is taken. I've offered it up. I would encourage you to act on it, but, you know, ignore it if you will. All right. With that, I'm going to bring this episode to an end. Thank you very much for subscribing. Thank you for listening. For those of you who will respond to me with thoughtful comments and different points of view, those different points of view are valuable to me. So special thanks for those who take the time to provide feedback. And for those who don't, hey, you are paying to hear these words. I very much appreciate that. The only difference between you and somebody who provides a lot of feedback for me is that I don't really have much sense of who you are. If I never hear from you, but I just see your name on Patreon or in the, you know, the receipts, the email receipts that I get from PayPal, there are names that I've seen monthly for years and years. I've never heard from these folks. Don't know a thing about them except that they listen, you know, they not only listen to the C-Realm podcast, but they pay to hear the extra stuff, which tells me a little something about you. Tells me enough to know that you're probably somebody I would enjoy, hoisting a beer with or drinking a coffee with, and maybe it'll happen. When this pandemic lifts, I intend to travel. I am feeling, as you probably know, quite stir crazy. I was ready to go before the pandemic. Okay, I'm done. There is no more content to this podcast. I will talk to you again soon. Stay well.
Nobody is more dangerous than he who imagines himself pure in heart, wrote James Baldwin. For his purity, by definition, is unassailable. This observation has been confirmed many times throughout history. However, China's Cultural Revolution offers perhaps the starkest illustration of just how dangerous the pure in heart can be. The ideological justification for the revolution was to purge the Chinese Communist Party, or CCP, and the nation more broadly, of impure elements hidden in its midst. Capitalists, counter-revolutionaries, and representatives of the bourgeoisie. To that end, Mao Zedong activated China's youth, emblemished and uncorrupted in heart and mind, to lead the struggle for purity. Christened the Red Guards, they were placed at the vanguard of a revolution that was, in truth, a cynical effort by Mao to reassert his waning power in the party. Nevertheless, it set in motion a self-destructive force of almost unimaginable depravity. The Cultural Revolution commenced in spirit when Mao published a letter indicting a number of party leaders on May 16, 1996. But it was a seemingly minor event 9 days later that ignited the revolution in effect. A young philosophy professor at Peking University named Ni Yuanzi placed a big character poster, a handwritten propaganda sheet featuring large Chinese characters, on a public bulletin board denouncing the university president and others in the administration as bourgeois revisionists. Mao immediately endorsed her protest, which set off a chain reaction of student revolt that swept through China. That chain reaction was accelerated by working groups of ideologues sent to administer schools. Under their tenure, schools became centers of activism rather than learning. Students were encouraged to create big character posters exposing their own teachers, officials, and even parents. The accused were humiliated in daily struggle sessions, in which their students and colleagues interrogated them and demanded confessions. The viciousness of these sessions rapidly intensified. Students beat, spat upon, and tortured in horrifically creative ways their often elderly teachers and professors. In one case, students demanded their biology professor stare at the sun with wide-open eyes. If he blinked or looked away, they beat him. Even middle and elementary school students participated in the struggle sessions, sometimes beating their teachers to death with sticks and belt buckles. Students were also encouraged to turn on their classmates. As the sins of one generation passed to the next, a new hierarchy was born. The children of revolutionaries on top and the children of landlords, capitalists, and rightists at the bottom. These students were labelled rotten eggs and were fair game for the same treatment meted out to their parents. The current president of the People's Republic of China, Xi Jinping, endured this fate. He was only 15 years old when his father, a loyal Maoist and one-time propaganda chief, was purged, his sister executed, and his own mother forced to denounce Xi as a reactionary. Amid the hysteria, teachers, professors, and intellectuals did not dare to stand up to the students or defend their colleagues lest they suffer similar fates. But they could not escape by being bystanders. With every word and action becoming potential evidence of capitalist sympathy, teachers and intellectuals enthusiastically joined their students in the struggle sessions and screaming rallies. Mao's decision to use China's youth as his vanguard was, by fortune or foresight, instrumental to the revolution's initial success. The young may be pure in heart, but they are also high on emotion and short on life experience. Simply put, they are natural Philistines. Still in their identity-forming years, China's youth had few barriers to a complete identification with the Red Guards. Conformity and intolerance of dissent followed naturally. When students were not attending rallies and struggle sessions, they spent endless hours studying and discussing Mao's Little Red Book. As Lu Lian, a former Red Guard, explained, "We were taught only about revolution, so when we read the works of propaganda literature, we really wanted to be at the head, at the vanguard of revolutionary history. With undeveloped mental immune systems, their soft skulls were fertile ground for Mao's secular Manichaeism. Manichaeism reduces society, with all the diversity and complexity of human experience, to a blunt dichotomy. Light and darkness, good and evil, right and wrong, radical and reactionary. There is no middle way," became a popular slogan. Ideologies like these are intellectually and morally vapid, yet their simplicity and certainty are alluring, especially to the young. Thus, Mao's child revolutionaries could, with youthful exuberance and clarity of purpose, chain a teacher to a radiator and bludgeon him to death with an iron bar, or force a teacher to eat nails and feces, among other tortures. The Red Guard's purity of mind, their youthful capacity for learning and openness to new ideas, also proved useful to Mao. Their plasticity was well-suited to the project of eradicating what was called the Four Olds: old customs, old culture, old habits, and old ideas. The Red Guards would impose a new symbolic order on an old world without the clutter or caution of life experience. Sometimes the results were comical. Since red symbolized the revolution, and the revolution must not stop, Red Guards demanded that vehicles drive rather than stop at red traffic lights. More often, the results were horrific. Because pet cats, dogs, fish, and even crickets became symbols of bourgeois decadence, they were slaughtered in their thousands. Eating human flesh became a macabre proof of loyalty. The party's own investigations tell of students in Zhuangzi province cooking and eating their teachers and principals. In some government cafeterias, the bodies of executed traitors were displayed on meat hooks while their flesh was served and consumed. The blank slate, it seems, can also be a dark abyss. Indeed, the nature and scale of the harms caused by the Cultural Revolution, which I have only touched on here, almost defy comprehension. Although educators and intellectuals were primary targets of the revolution, they bore some responsibility, by acts of commission or omission, for creating the conditions of its possibility. In the years prior to the Cultural Revolution, the party had cultivated an environment of extreme political conformity. Political rallies and self-criticism sessions had become a regular feature of Maoist thought reform campaigns. Zhi Jianlin, a professor of languages at Peking, detailed how eagerly the teachers and intellectuals had supported these campaigns. In his memoir, The Cowshed, Memories of the Chinese Cultural Revolution, Xi writes with regret of his own aptitude in crowd behavior. He had been a true believer in Maoism and willingly persecuted other intellectuals during the socialist education movement in 1957. But his party loyalty was no defense when the revolution eventually came for him. A year into the Cultural Revolution, he found himself denounced by friends, colleagues, and students. Already in his late 50s, he was imprisoned with other intellectuals in a cowshed with former students as his sadistic prison guards. He was forced to endure constant struggle sessions and beaten and tormented mercilessly by his colleagues and Red Guards. Eventually, even Mao acknowledged that the situation was spiraling out of control. In 1967, the People's Liberation Army, or PLA, was ordered to suppress the Red Guards, and they did so with great brutality. Many of the young radicals were killed in clashes with the PLA, while countless others perished in mass executions. But most were sent to labor camps in the countryside, including Ni Yuanzi, the young professor who had hung the first big character poster at Peking University. After the Red Guards were contained, the intensity of the Cultural Revolution declined. It officially ended with Mao's death in 1976. All told, the death toll is estimated to have been around 400,000 and several million people. Tens of millions more were injured in acts of extreme cruelty and depravity. The word revolution connotes turning, cycling, revolving. Cycles, and perhaps revolutions, are inescapable in nature, the laws of which command, with unbroken precedent, that the young will succeed the old. The Cultural Revolution, however, was deeply defective. Led by young idealists and animated by the forces of purity and paranoia, the revolution could yield only mayhem. No society, no person, no thing can satisfy the Platonic ideal of purity. Hence, its pursuit ensured no end to struggle. More insidiously, the target of purification, the enemy, the disease, the rot, was internal. External threats are visible. They announce themselves by flag, appearance, ethos, and the like. The internal threat is hidden. The enemy is at once nowhere and everywhere. Thus, everyone was suspect. Teachers, friends, and even family members. Hidden enemies must be exposed before they can be purified. Therefore, self-criticism, re-education, and public confession are peculiar but necessary practices in the inward war. Show trials, struggle sessions, and inquisitions satisfy the ideology's existential need for conflict by creating enemies out of comrades. In order to avoid persecution during the Cultural Revolution, many were quick to accuse others, thereby creating a feedback loop of ever-intensifying ideological fanaticism and violence. Inevitably, the accusers became the accused, and the torturers became the tortured. As each confession validated the Red Guard's paranoia, the revolution mutated into something like an autoimmune disorder that attacks what it is meant to protect. This was, in fact, what the CCP's Central Committee concluded about the Cultural Revolution in 1981. In a remarkably candid retrospective, the Central Committee acknowledged that it was we and not the enemy at all who were thrown into disorder by the Cultural Revolution, which they judged responsible for the most severe setback and the heaviest losses suffered by the party, the state, and the people since the founding of the People's Republic. The revolution's descent into anarchy and violence calls to mind the first stanza of W.B. Yeats's famous poem, The Second Coming, which begins with the turning and turning in the widening gear. For the Cultural Revolution, it reads like prophecy, a forewarning of what transpires when a people, united around a single unassailable vision, finds its enemies by turning inwards. With no competing visions or ability to self-correct, the turning continues, the gear widens, and soon things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Much has been written recently about the excesses of political polarization and the prevalence of an us-versus-them mentality in politics. The Cultural Revolution, however, offers a chilling example of the dangers of an excess of political homogeneity. To be sure, Maoism preached the Manichaean gospel of good versus evil, but all were agreed that Maoism was correct, even sometimes especially those who were purged. Conflicts were only over who practiced the purest version of the ideology, not over competing doctrines, because there were none. It was this lack of distinguishable us and them that drove the revolution to turn inward in search of enemies and impurities. In liberal democracies, by contrast, purity politics may occur within factions and parties, but the real competition is between conflicting political values and ideologies, all of which provide the productive tension that drives social progress. Of course, liberal democracy is itself a political ideology, but it is uniquely structured around a conception of pluralism that can accommodate disparate visions of what constitutes the good life. Elections, among other things, act as self-correcting mechanisms. A party that purges its impure elements inevitably strengthens its competition. This limits the potential depravity and destructiveness of purity politics, which was not the case in China. Nevertheless, the instinct to conform and to be accepted by our peers is strong within us all, especially the young. When the undercurrents of popular culture pull us towards conformity, democracy alone is no cure, nor is it enough to preach tolerance. There must also exist a multiplicity of views to tolerate. When we tell ourselves and teach our children that diversity is our strength, it can sound a lot like dogma. Even so, it is a dogma worth supporting if it is intended to extol diversity of thought and opinion, a diversity that rewards contrarians who reject the safety of the herd, and those who embody the spirit of dissent, nonconformity, and individualism. Nietzsche once warned that the surest way to corrupt a youth is to instruct him to hold in higher esteem those who think alike than those who think differently. It is a warning we should heed.